liberal political philosopher of the 20th century, furthered the idea in his 1971 book, A Theory of Justice, now required reading for any college philosophy student or White House employee. The book was based around a thought experiment whereby people would determine how government should be set up in order to bring about political and economic justice. The trick, however, is that participants had to reach their conclusions behind a veil of ignorance, meaning that they did not know how their life would turn out, whether they'd be a bum or a billionaire. Rawls concluded that there are two basic principles needed for a society to function justly. One, the liberty principle. This is the idea that people should have political freedoms, such as free speech, freedom of the press, and be treated equally under the law. Not many people take issue with this. Two, the difference principle. Because participants in the thought experiment did not know their outcomes, Rawls claimed that the just decision these people came to was that wealth should be distributed so that the worst off benefit the most. In essence, it's this theory that progressives are trying to implement through all of their social programs and tax systems. The only problem is that we are no longer in a thought experiment. There's a very good reason why progressive big government presidents like FDR and LBJ love the idea of equality, and it has nothing to do with what good guys they were. Equality means power, because equality requires enforcement. LBJ, who used civil rights for his own political advantage, understood this concept very well. What good are equal rights if you don't have all sorts of commissions, agencies, and groups to monitor them? Likewise, creating equal outcomes requires a very strong central authority to implement the laws, ensure that everyone is obeying them, and punish those who aren't. Economist Thomas Sowell once put it like this: "The question becomes, are you going to have everyone play by the same rules, or are you going to try to rectify the shortcomings, errors, and failures of the entire cosmos? Because those things are wholly incompatible. If you're going to have people play by the same rules, that can be enforced with a minimum amount of interference with people's freedom. But if you're going to try to make the entire cosmos right and just, somebody has got to have an awful lot of power to impose what they think is right on an awful lot of other people. What we've seen, particularly in the 20th century, is that putting that much power in anyone's hands is enormously dangerous." Whenever conservatives or libertarians talk about these kinds of ideas, the vitriol from the other side bursts out. They scream about racism and hate and wonder how we will ever protect the mentally handicapped, the diseased, or the people who've been struck by catastrophe without safety nets. But it's a false argument. Equality of opportunity doesn't need to overlook the weakest among us. There is clearly a constitutional and certainly moral role for government in helping certain groups of people. Hayek, a staunch libertarian and one of the most revered free market economists of all time, actually believed that there should be some kind of social safety net provided by the state. But don't get too excited, liberals. His conception of a social backstop is quite different from Barack Obama's. In the Constitution of Liberty, Hayek asserted that the state should provide assistance, within reason, for the weak, sick, or those who were victims of unforeseeable, that's a key word, disasters. But he strongly argued against the rationale that because some in society are born into poor families while others are born into rich families, it means that the former have a right to the assets of the latter. In other words, Hayek would probably have agreed that there was a role for the government in Hurricane Katrina's aftermath, but that increasing taxes to pay for public schools to give out iPods is probably unwise. Here is Hayek in his own words: "There are good reasons why we should endeavor to use whatever political organization we have at our disposal to make provision for the weak or infirm or for the victims of unforeseeable disaster. It may well be true that the most effective method of providing against certain risks common to all citizens of a state is to give every citizen protection against those risks. The level on which such provisions against common risks can be made will necessarily depend on the general wealth of the community. It is an entirely different matter, however, to suggest that those who are poor, merely in the sense that there are those in the same community who are richer, are entitled to a share in the wealth of the latter, or that being born into a group that has reached a particular level of civilization and comfort confers a title to a share in all its benefits. The fact that all citizens have an interest in the common provision of some services is no justification for anyone's claiming as a right a share in all the benefits. It may set a standard for what some ought to be willing to give, but not for what anyone can demand. America, where the real king is a dead singer. Thomas Jefferson once wrote, "There is a natural aristocracy among men. The grounds of this are virtue and talents." Not that I need to clarify TJ's point, but he meant that, unlike his motherland, nobility in America wasn't based on birthright. It was based on individual success and achievement. Our founders believed that individuals all possessed different abilities, ambitions, and levels of work ethic. And that was a good thing. In fact, their main concern was over what Jefferson called an artificial aristocracy, made up of people who were born wealthy or into the right family, but lacked virtue or talent. They worried that these people, if put into positions of power in government, would become a danger to the country because they had not earned their position. Jefferson's solution was surprisingly simple. "I think the best remedy is exactly that provided by all our constitutions, to leave to the citizens the free election and separation of the natural aristocracy from the artificial, of the wheat from the chaff. In general, they will elect the really good and wise. In some instances, wealth may corrupt and birth blind them, but not in sufficient degree to endanger the society." I guess I first have to point out that Jefferson was wrong about one thing. Americans no longer tend to always elect the good and wise, but he was right about everything else. Unlike Europe, our social hierarchy has overwhelmingly been based on merit. That's the very essence of the American dream. Work hard for your success, and you not only earn respect, you may also earn a fortune. But achieve success through luck or birthright, for example, Paris Hilton, and while you may still earn that fortune, you won't be able to buy any respect with it. But the welfare state and entitlement culture is changing that entire equation. Individual achievement is no longer celebrated as it once was. Why give the best player on the team a trophy when that might hurt feelings? Instead, give all the players a trophy and celebrate mediocrity. Unfortunately, when you cherish mediocrity for too long, you eventually become mediocre yourself. We must turn our backs on that way of thinking. Celebrate diversity, not only in appearance, but in aptitude and ability. Celebrate accomplishments, not only when the least talented succeed, but also when the most talented do. And celebrate hard work, certainly when it pays off, but especially when it doesn't. Those three values have been taken from us and twisted. If we can restore them, we can restore America. A deadly sin that's not so deadly. Some progressives, like famed professor and liberal theorist Ronald Dworkin, are so serious about equality that they've developed a simple test to determine whether it's being achieved. Envy. If envy exists, then so does inequality. Using envy as the benchmark test is yet another progressive word game. Are you detecting a trend here? Envy is one of the seven deadly sins, so who could possibly be in favor of it? But envy is really the wrong standard to apply. Envy is a human condition that can't be eliminated. Unless everyone is exactly the same in every possible way, then some form of envy will always exist. Envy, of course, can lead to anger and bitterness and demands that you get what your neighbor has, which is exactly what led to the downfall of ancient Greece. But in the hands of someone who believes in themselves, envy can also be one of life's greatest motivators. Jealous of the guy who's dating the girl you like? You're motivated to lose those last 10 pounds. Jealous of your coworker who makes more money? You're motivated to work harder and longer. Jealous of your teammate who hits more home runs? You're motivated to get stronger and spend more time at practice. A distinction has to be made, however, between envy and another one of the deadly sins, greed. Envy for the sake of simply accumulating more stuff is not what this country is all about. But envy for the sake of the reward it brings, for the chance to reap the fruits of your own labor and ideas, is exactly what this country is about. The problem with trying to eliminate envy is that even when we succeed, we fail. If a teacher takes all of the students who got C's on a test and marks them up to an A, are those students really better off? Have they really reaped the rewards of their own talent and hard work? Progressives don't seem to understand that designing identical trophies is not the issue. The issue is whether you were handed it for participating or whether you earned it by being the best. Most progressives won't actually mention the role that envy plays in their push for classlessness. One who did was James Dusenberry, who sat on LBJ's Council of Economic Advisors and was former chairman of the Harvard Economics Department. In other words, Dusenberry was no slouch. He believed that a group's sense of economic well-being was based on how well the group above them was doing. If the group above them was successful, a sense of deprivation was created, and it became necessary to bring the more prosperous group down. One way to do that was through the progressive income tax. Economist E.J. Mishan of the London School of Economics furthered Dusenberry's theory. He wrote, "Ideally, of course, the tax should suffice to cover all the initial and subsequent claims necessary to placate everybody in the lower income groups. And the stronger is this envy of others, the heavier must be the tax." So according to Mishan, tax rates wouldn't be based on economic need. They'd be based on the degree of envy of those below you on the income ladder. Sounds like a pretty strong foundation to build an enduring country on. Two University of Chicago law professors, Walter Bloom and Harry Calvin, wanted to research this idea further, so they asked people a simple question. If America suddenly became three times richer overnight, but the change in the relative distribution of money did not change, would redistribution still be pushed? The clear answer? Absolutely. It initially appears that what is involved is envy, the dissatisfaction produced in men not by what they lack, but by what others have. Basically, what Bloom and Calvin discovered is that everything is relative. If you think you are well off, but then someone moves next door who seems like they have even more, then you suddenly become envious and in favor of redistribution. We know where this false journey toward equality ends because Tocqueville described it long ago. After having thus successively taken each member of the community into its powerful grasp and fashioned him at will, the supreme power then extends its arm over the whole community. It covers the surface of society with a network of small, complicated rules, minute and uniform, through which the most original minds and the most energetic characters cannot penetrate to rise above the crowd. The will of man is not shattered, but softened, bent, and guided. Men are seldom forced by it to act, but they are constantly restrained from acting. Such a power does not destroy, but it prevents existence. It does not tyrannize, but it compresses, enervates, extinguishes, and stupefies a people till each nation is reduced to nothing better than a flock of timid and industrious animals, of which the government is the shepherd. Our only defense is to open up enough eyes to what is really going on. We've already seen how the language has been shaped and changed by progressives: positive rights, a living constitution, freedom from want, equality as a positive, and envy as a negative. Maybe it's time to fight back with some word games of our own, words like diversity, success, motivation, and personal achievement. We can talk about fixing the budget and reforming social programs all we want, but those programs are simply a manifestation of the progressive push toward equality. Until that is exposed for the false idol that it is, no budget plan will ever go anywhere. In other words, we cannot reform entitlements without first reforming equality. If we are unsuccessful, or worse, if we do nothing, then I guarantee you that envy will be nothing compared to the next deadly sin we will face: wrath.
Can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we have removed their only firm basis, a conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are a gift of God, that they are not to be violated but with His wrath? Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that His justice cannot sleep forever. Thomas Jefferson. Chapter 15. Step 3. Faith in America. When was the last time you trembled while thinking about God? Well, if it's been a while, why? Did God issue some sort of statement that since humans are doing such a great job here on Earth, he's decided to no longer judge them? Did he declare that he will cease to admonish or reward leaders and nations for their actions? The answer is, no, not so much. He didn't suddenly change his mind. He didn't read liberal blogs and decide, hey, I'm no longer important. And he didn't much care for all the court decisions trying to remove him from society. He doesn't waver, falter. He doesn't flip-flop like John Kerry on a campaign trail, because his truths are absolute. It is we who have changed. It doesn't take a religious scholar to see that America has turned away from God. In fact, it only takes about 5 minutes of channel surfing, a browse past the magazine rack, or a quick scan of the spam folder in your email to figure that out. And possibly, for the first time in this audiobook, the blame does not solely fall on progressives. While they make an easy target because they often openly mock God and religion in general, yes, I do cling to guns and my God. Thanks for asking. Each and every one of us have contributed to this neglect. Be honest. If the priorities in your life were graphed on a pie chart, how big of a slice would God get? My intention is not to lecture you. I'm as guilty as anyone on this. Believe me, there's nothing I'd like to do more than sleep in on Sunday morning, play with the kids, pop in a DVD. We're all at fault for shifting our priorities. It's in our very nature to turn towards false idols like money, possessions, power, celebrity. Throughout history, the consistent consequence of disobeying God's law has been clear. Adam and Eve, they were kicked out of the garden. When the Israelites didn't fully follow God, God burned with anger and made them wander around in the desert until an entire generation who had done the wickedness in his sight were consumed. Why would we think that our spiritual neglect today would get some sort of free pass from God when no other generation throughout history ever has? If you believe, as I do, that the founders' work in creating this nation was divinely inspired, then you should also believe that God is not going to look kindly at the dismantling of what it was that he created. If we want a different result than other civilizations, then you know what? We have to start making different decisions. Virtue must replace vanity. Godliness must replace greed and gluttony. Fear and trembling must replace power and arrogance. God set this nation apart, and God expects us to take care of the gifts we're given. But don't expect to see punishment through fire or flood if we don't. I think God allows us to reap the rewards or suffer the consequences of our own decisions. You see, to God, none of us is too big to fail. The path towards healing does not begin with some unnamed hedonistic progressive activist. It begins with you. Now, at this point, you may be saying to yourself, this is a cool story and all, Glenn, but isn't this an audio book about fixing our economy? Yep, it is. But our financial renewal cannot begin without our spiritual renewal. We are all broke, as I told you at the beginning, because we are all broken. We are like a ship lost at sea, bobbing in the waves and moving in whatever direction the prevailing wind blows. To reach our destination, we need a North Star, a fixed object that can lead us in the right direction. That polar star is God.
Founding Faith. Like individual rights and diversity, faith was a bedrock principle at our country's founding. It was the glue that kept our republic together. The founders understood that sins could never be eradicated through legislation. As the Bible reminds us, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. The founders' Judeo-Christian heritage told them that men are not perfect, so don't waste time trying to make them that way. Here is how James Madison, the primary author of the Constitution, put it in Federalist 51. "But what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human nature? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself." That really puts into perspective the founders' mindset as they drafted our Constitution. The only difference between America and all the other countries that have tried to develop systems to control both the masses and the government itself is religion. A strong belief in something greater than man acts as a natural brake on unconstrained capitalism. You don't rob or scam another person because you fear both the temporary punishment of the state and the eternal punishment of your God. A common way of looking at the necessity for religion in a republic is what is called the moral calculus. In short, a republic can function only if a sufficient percentage of the population is virtuous. But virtue requires morality, and morality requires religion, or at least a belief in a higher power to which we will ultimately be accountable. As Benjamin Franklin, who by his own admission was a deist, once said, "Only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. As nations become corrupt and vicious, they have more need of masters." Professors Donald S. Lutz and the late Charles S. Heineman once studied 15,000 political items that were published or written by the American founders. They also reviewed 2,200 books, pamphlets, and newspaper articles on politics from the period surrounding the Revolution. What they found was that the most commonly referenced source in these materials was the Bible, making up 34% of all citations. The most cited writers and thinkers were not deists or agnostics, but Christian thinkers like Montesquieu and Blackstone. Far from shying away from a spiritual influence, our founders embraced it. They believed that the reason the Constitution would work in America was that our love of religion made us unique from any other country in the history of the world. As John Adams said, "Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate for the government of any other." Speaking of France, Alexis de Tocqueville seemed to marvel at the role religion played in America in the early 19th century. I apologize for including so much of his description of that experience, but I think it's critical to understand that religion was not simply represented by a prayer before dinner or an hour on Sundays. It was woven into the very fabric of our society. Tocqueville wrote, "Whilst the law permits the Americans to do what they please, religion prevents them from conceiving and forbids them to commit what is rash or unjust." Religion in America takes no direct part in the government of society, but it must nevertheless be regarded as the foremost of the political institutions of that country, for it does not impart a taste for freedom, it facilitates the use of free institutions. I do not know whether all the Americans have a sincere faith in their religion, for who can search the human heart? But I am certain that they hold it to be indispensable to the maintenance of republican institutions. This opinion is not peculiar to a class of citizens or to a party, but it belongs to the whole nation and to every rank of society. The Americans combine the notions of Christianity and of liberty so intimately in their minds that it is impossible to make them conceive of one without the other. While I believe we can blame only ourselves for the way faith has been tossed aside, there's no doubt that progressives understand the role of religion in American history well and have worked hard to whitewash it. After all, if people can rely on each other for help, moderate their excesses, and govern according to God's rules, then what need do they have for a strong central government? Separating church and state, or church from the state? I'm confused. Tocqueville said that religion was regarded as a foremost political institution in the early 19th century, but how could that be, given that our founders built an enormous wall between church and state? The answer lies in the fact that the meaning of separation of church and state, a term that does not appear in the Constitution itself, or any other federal document for that matter, has completely changed over time. It's like a game of telephone tag, where someone says, no government religion at one end, and by the time the message gets to the last person, it's recited as, no religion in government. The First Amendment was intended to apply solely to the federal government so that it could not overrule state churches and establish a national religion. Why was that deemed necessary? Because at the time the Constitution was ratified, at least 10 of the 13 states had some provision recognizing Christianity as the official or recommended religion in their state constitutions, and would have failed any modern test of separation of church and state. In fact, reading many of the state constitutions of that time is an eye-opening exercise. The 1780 Massachusetts Constitution, written by John Adams, declared in part, "The good order and preservation of civil government essentially depends upon piety, religion, and morality, by the institution of public worship of God and of the public instructions in piety, religion, and morality." North Carolina's 1776 Constitution went even further, leaving no doubt as to their intentions. "No person who shall deny the being of God, or the truth of the Protestant religion, or the divine authority of either the Old or New Testaments, or who shall hold religious principles incompatible with the freedom and safety of the state, for example, pacifism, shall be capable of holding any office, place of trust or profit in the civil department within this state." State governments were free to put as much or as little separation between themselves and religion as they desired. It was only the power of the federal government to mandate a national religion that concerned the founders. So where does the famous separation of church and state line come from? It was actually in a letter written by Thomas Jefferson to the Danbury Baptists in 1802. The Baptists, concerned that the government might interfere with their right to worship, had appealed to Jefferson for advice. In assuring them that their rights were as unalienable as the rights of any religion, he wrote the Baptists and told them that the First Amendment ensured their freedom and that there was a wall of separation between church and state that would prevent the government from ever interfering in their right to worship the way they pleased. Like many of the words of our founders, the meaning of Jefferson's letter has been completely changed over the years to suit the agenda of those who would prefer that he was talking about religion infiltrating our government instead of the other way around. It's also important to note that our founders backed up their words with actions. One day after passing the First Amendment, which contains the Establishment Clause that has been used to claim they did not want any religion in government, Congress declared a public day of prayer. Don't you think it would be pretty odd to declare a public day of government-sponsored prayer if you just created a constitutional amendment banning the government from sponsoring prayer? While our founders embraced Judeo-Christian beliefs, this is not a plea for people to practice or convert to any specific faith. I really couldn't care less if you're a Jew, a Mormon, a Roman Catholic, or a Wiccan. The point is to believe in and honor the God of your choosing, because it is our Creator who gave us our rights. Okay, maybe I do care a little bit if you're a Wiccan. As soon as God is taken out of the equation, then nothing is left but man. And if our rights come from man, they can be taken away by man. That is why anyone who really understands individual liberty, like Penn Jillette, for example, should support America's embrace of faith, even if they don't believe in God themselves. Thomas Paine, who, by all accounts, was not a fan of organized religion, nevertheless understood that faith and liberty go hand in hand. "Spiritual freedom is the root of all political liberty," he said. "As the union between spiritual freedom and political liberty seems nearly inseparable, it is our duty to defend both. Our agendas, ensuring that no man can infringe on another's natural rights, are the same, even if our beliefs aren't." Faith is more than just a belief in a specific religious doctrine. It's something that fills us from the inside. It makes us whole. If you strip that away, something has to fill the void. More than 50 years ago, philosopher José Ortega y Gasset wrote, "Without commandments, obliging us to live after a certain fashion, our existence is that of the unemployed. By dint of feeling itself free, exempt from restrictions, it feels itself empty. Before long, there will be heard throughout the planet a formidable cry, rising like the howling of innumerable dogs to the stars, asking for someone or something to take command, to impose an occupation, a duty. That's a pretty good description of exactly what progressives are going for. Nature abhors a vacuum, so if spirituality does not fill a person, then things like envy, greed, and a sense of entitlement will. To move toward that vacuum, progressives push reason instead of religion, government instead of God, and taxes instead of charity. They agree with Freud, who said of religion, "Let us put away childish things." And they work to kick God out of our schools, bar him from our courtrooms, boot his likeness off our town squares, and lock him out of government completely. Progressives have gone to absurd lengths to dim the North Star that has been guiding us as a nation for more than 200 years. Back in 1981, the president of Yale University told incoming freshmen that the Moral Majority, which was then a politically active group of evangelical Christians, were peddlers of coercion. The Los Angeles Times pulled Johnny Hart's cartoon B.C. when, for Easter, he depicted a caveman writing a poem that read, "Never to mourn the prince who was downed, for he is not lost, it is you who are found." They didn't run it because, in the words of the newspaper's spokesperson, the cartoon was insensitive and exclusionary. And then there are other well-publicized pushes to rip the Ten Commandments from courthouses, remove mangers from public display, and eliminate references to Christmas from our schools and the phrase "under God" from the Pledge of Allegiance. In Utah, the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals recently ruled that roadside crosses memorializing the deaths of highway patrol troopers are unconstitutional. "We hold that these memorials have the impermissible effect of conveying to the reasonable observer the message that the state prefers or otherwise endorses a certain religion," the court wrote. I've even had my own experience with this supposed wall of separation. During the organizing of an event at the Kennedy Center in Washington, I was told that no prayers could be recited from the stage. Prayers are not exactly baptism or communion, they're prayers, things that millions of people say every day. Presumably, if you were paying to come to my event, an event that was called Divine Destiny, by the way, then you'd probably be okay with an appeal toward God at the beginning of the program. The whole idea of watering down religion in the hope of not upsetting people has just gone way too far. Some of the religious targets of progressives seem pretty silly. I mean, who could really be offended by a manger set up on a lawn or crosses memorializing deceased heroes? But that's part of their whole attack. Remove all references from the massive to the mundane so that over time, religion is extracted from our lives. The late Christopher Lash, who was no conservative, asked, "What accounts for our society's wholesale defection from the standards of personal conduct, civility, industry, self-restraint, that were once considered indispensable to democracy?" His answer? The gradual decay of religion would stand somewhere near the head of the list. And he pointed to a familiar villain as the culprit, liberal elites. "Among elites," Lash wrote, "religion is held in low esteem, something useful for wedding and funerals, but otherwise dispensable. The elite's attitude to religion ranges from indifference to active hostility." The social gospel. At the heart of this change is the social gospel, a theory that the book American Progressivism describes like this. Social gospel embraced evolutionary theory, although not its survival of the fittest determinism, and saw orthodox religion as insufficient for the times. Social gospel posited evolution as a divine plan for rational social advancement, and suggested that it become possible, through an empowered central state, to realize the Christian hope that thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Social gospel adherents considered it to be their mission to fulfill in this life the New Testament's call to bring about the perfect kingdom of God. The socialism preached in the social gospel is far more dangerous than atheistic socialism because social gospel followers believe they are bringing about God's will. The atheist may take away our economic freedom, but the Christian socialist will do that while also taking away our freedom to worship. They must dilute and twist the real Christian message and replace it with this idea that the state can somehow usher in God's will. The logical conclusion of this process is that when the state ushers in God's will, as determined by the state, politicians become the priests, and the state itself becomes God. At that point, there is no role for churches, since secular schools and universities will provide all religious instruction. That will lead to full social justice, where all people other than the ruling elites will live equally as serfs, without individual liberties, private property, or most importantly, freedom of religion. Restore faith, restore America. Real faith renews our spirit of hard work and independence. Faith restores the idea of a society based on merit and reward. The Bible says, "If a man will not work, he shall not eat." 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 10. Jesus dignified work when he said, "The worker deserves his wages." Luke chapter 10, verse 7. In the parable of the talents, he actually condemns those who don't do the best with what they have been given. The one who invested and doubled his 5 talents is praised, and he faults the one who is given 5 talents but does nothing with them. With a spiritual reawakening, we can take responsibility for ourselves again, embrace the virtues of hard work, and reignite purpose and direction in our country. With faith, there are no bailouts for failure, because failure is not negative. With faith, there are no entitlements, because neighbors help neighbors. The Puritans used to sing a hymn that included this verse: "Dare to be a Daniel, dare to stand alone, dare to have a purpose firm, dare to make it known." Following World War II, George Orwell, who was not exactly a libertarian, commented that the hymn needed to be updated with the word "don't" added to the beginning of each line. Even he saw that the British people were losing that sense of individual purpose and boldness that had served them so well for so long. Have we? Only God knows what he has planned for the future of America, but I know that we can't fix our broken country without his help. It's no coincidence that our economic decline can be charted right alongside our spiritual decline, or that our reliance on big government can be charted side by side with our retreat from God. As the founders struggled over the language of the Constitution in 1787, Ben Franklin addressed George Washington with these words: "I have lived, sir, a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this, that God governs the affairs of men. And if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We have been assured, sir, in the sacred writings, that, except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. I firmly believe this, and I also believe that, without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel." Do we still believe that, or do most people now think that an enduring America can be built in the image of man? Do we still respect the need for his approval, or are we trying to build our own tower into the sky without his help? America's founding was a miracle, and her survival through dark days of depression, civil war, and enemy aggression proves that the guiding spirit of God's hand is still with us. But the more we turn from him, the more likely it is that the next time the sky gets dark, there will be no North Star to guide us towards safety. Efficiency of state governments is impaired as they relinquish and turn over to the federal government responsibilities which are rightfully theirs. Calvin Coolidge. Chapter 16. Step 4. Decentralize and disconnect. The world of innovation and the world that is our federal government are on 2 separate bullet trains headed in opposite directions. Technology is getting smaller, faster, and is doing more with less. The federal government is getting bigger, slower, and doing less with more. The new trend in business is decentralization. The trend in government is exactly the opposite. Over the last century, the government has taken control of virtually everything it could get its hands on, from education to energy, from finance to healthcare. It's hard to understate the enormity of what has happened, but consider this. the number of federal regulators has more than tripled over the last 50 years to keep up with the government's growth. And yet, for all the talk about innovation and technology, most of government's policy prescriptions remain surprisingly clunky and outmoded. When they want to fix the auto industry, they appoint a czar. When they want to tackle environmental issues, they appoint a czar. Healthcare, green jobs, bank bailouts, czar, czar, czar. It's ironic, but to cut through their bureaucracy and get things done, politicians like to create another level of bureaucracy. That, of course, is the opposite of how successful companies operate. The tendency in business is toward shifting away from centralized technology and a top-down management style, and replacing it with a looser, flattened, decentralized management. Out with the old mainframe computer, in with the iPad. Out with middle managers in corporate headquarters, in with franchise owners or branch managers who have real authority. The reason this trend is happening is simple. It works. Just look around at the companies that are doing well. I can guarantee you that very few of them have a centralized bureaucracy with workers paid to punch the clock instead of innovate, create, and make informed decisions. Take Johnson & Johnson, for example. It has 76 years of sales increases, 25 consecutive years of adjusted earnings increases, and 47 years of dividend increases. Not too shabby. And right there on its website, the hyper-successful company gives away one of the most important reasons for its success. Johnson & Johnson is organized on the principles of decentralization management. CEO William Weldon told a conference at the Wharton School of Business that the decentralized approach sparks innovation, in that it allows different people with different skills, different thoughts, to bring together different products and technologies to satisfy the unmet needs of patients or customers. Lou Gerstner, CEO of IBM in the 1990s, turned that company around by decentralizing it. "Let's decentralize decision-making wherever possible," he once told managers. Gerstner's total quality movement empowered employees and forced them to take responsibility for their actions, and it worked. IBM's stock price increased by a factor of almost 10 under his leadership. Technology is decentralizing power and giving individuals more choices and freedom at lower costs and higher quality. The internet itself is about as decentralized a system as could ever be created, although some are even trying to centralize control of that. You can pick the applications you want on your cell phone, do your banking online, buy virtually any product on the planet from anywhere else on the planet, and get news from a whole host of sources, some as small as an individual, some as large as a Fortune 500 corporation. And that's exactly the point. Decentralization helps create more freedom. We are in the midst of a revolution in decision-making and control, and the reason is simple. Decentralization improves performance, generates new innovations, and empowers individuals by encouraging them to take on greater responsibility in return for greater potential rewards. Decentralization is taking hold everywhere, except in Washington. The original management consultants. Like most of the good ideas that we are now rediscovering, decentralization was first embraced by the ultimate innovators, the founders. They believed deeply in empowering individuals, not only because it would result in decision-making closer to the actual problem, but also because spreading power out ensured that it could never be amassed in one place. I mentioned earlier that I was struck in researching this book by how many of the best ideas that came up can already be found in the Constitution. This one is no exception. The 10th Amendment, ratified in 1791, was created to act as a safety net, a second layer of protection, just in case people would eventually be dumb enough to not understand that the whole intent of the Constitution was to limit federal power. It reads, "The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people." It's simple, straightforward, and just as the founders feared, almost entirely ignored. The system by which the states were supposed to be laboratories of democracy, mostly free from federal interference, is called federalism, and its benefits were defended in the aptly titled Federalist Papers. In number 39, titled Conformity of the Plan to Republican Principles, for example, James Madison wrote, "Each state, in ratifying the Constitution, is considered as a sovereign body, independent of all others, and only to be bound by its own voluntary act. In this relation, then, the new Constitution will, if established, be a federal and not a national constitution." If our founders wanted to create a purely national government, even with states still in existence, then they would have set up a majority rule system. The president would be elected based on a national popular vote, as would senators and representatives. Instead, presidential elections are handled via electoral votes based on state population. Representatives are assigned the same way. Only the Senate provides a true equal balance of representation among the states at the national level. This was an entirely new concept in government, a system with some national features and some federal features. It wasn't a democracy, it was a true republic, the first ever to be tried on the planet, and it was genius. The founders had seen the freedom-robbing consequences of what centralization under a powerful king had meant. They understood that liberty expands as centralization contracts. So they went small. They took government local. They wanted the lowest-level decision-makers to be the first ones to decide. But they also recognized that some problems that start in the states are truly of national importance, which is why the federal government was not stripped of all its power. In fact, Article 6 of the Constitution declares that the Constitution itself is the supreme law of the land, a clause that gives the government tremendous power to defend the rights that are spelled out in the document. But only those rights. Everything else, as the 10th Amendment made clear, was to be left to the states or to the people. It's that distinction that seems to have confused people over the years, and Ronald Reagan addressed it head-on in a 1987 executive order on federalism. It is important to recognize the distinction between problems of national scope, which may justify federal action, and problems that are merely common to the states, which will not justify federal action because individual states, acting individually or together, can effectively deal with them. The trick, of course, is how you define each of those problems. Poverty, a problem common to all states, is to me a local issue. Leaders in West Virginia can understand and react to the plight of coal mine workers better than a bureaucrat in D.C. can. Leaders in Detroit know the intricacies of the auto business and what it's going to take to help laid-off workers. Leaders in New York City have seen firsthand the consequences of market collapses and federal regulation of Wall Street and can help those displaced workers transition their lives. It's a perfect recipe for accountability and for ensuring that decisions are made based on the realities of a specific situation instead of the generalities of an entire country. But others contend that poverty is a problem of national scope that can best be handled by the federal government through large aid programs. Of course, those people don't want to cut state aid and have the feds take over. They want all levels of government involved, something that, as we've seen, not only doesn't work, but is also massively expensive. The key thing to remember is that neither federal nor local control can ever eliminate a problem like poverty. Those who declare that as a goal may have a bleeding heart, but they also likely have a bleeding brain. So the question becomes, which system gives us the best chance at using taxpayer money most efficiently and effectively? By that standard, I believe it's no contest. Federal aid can never compete with local assistance. For a while, most of our leaders seem to agree with that. Before the Civil War, petitions to the federal government for aid or subsidies were rarely approved. In 1817, for example, President James Madison vetoed a road and canal construction bill for being unconstitutional. Even for a time after the war, presidents still took the idea of states' rights pretty seriously. Grover Cleveland famously turned down a request to help Texas farmers trying to recover from a terrible drought, and he routinely scolded those looking for federal funds to enhance their local communities. Why it works. Professor Lino Graglia of the University of Texas Law School once explained that keeping power decentralized and at a local level controls the tyranny and produces greater diversity and respect for individual preferences. It can be shown arithmetically, Graglia wrote, that as an issue is decided by larger units involving more people, the likelihood increases that fewer people will obtain their preference and more will be disappointed. Let me put that into more relatable terms. You and your spouse are deciding which school to send your child to. You have four choices: public, charter, private, or homeschool. The two of you agree that, for various reasons, you want to go the homeschooling route. But personal decisions are no longer allowed. Your entire extended family must decide for you. Over a long weekend, the whole family flies into town, gets together in a room, and debates what to do about not only your child, but two others as well, one who's a cousin from California and another who's a cousin from Detroit. The family hears from all of the different parents who lobby for their choice. The cousins from California prefer a private school, while those from Detroit were recently laid off and can afford only the public option. At the end of the weekend, the family decides that the best compromise seems to be the charter school. It's cheaper than the private option and of a higher quality than the public option. The decision is announced and binding on all three sets of parents, and none of them like the result. Had they each decided according to their own needs and circumstances, things would have turned out much differently. It's an extreme example, of course, but it's not that far off from the way federal programs really operate. It's one size fits all, and it forces the states to accept suboptimal solutions simply because the group consensus in Washington has dictated a specific agenda. Professor Graglia went on to explain that local control also means less overall government spending. Why? Because the costs of local government programs are felt more immediately by taxpayers and therefore result in less waste and fewer spending sprees. You can see proof of this in property taxes. They are always under intense scrutiny because people believe they can actually influence them. Property taxes aren't sent off to some no-name processing center in a faraway state. They're sent right to the town hall. Politicians who spend that money better do it wisely. The trouble with federal control is that it blurs accountability. Pennsylvanians who receive money from the federal government figure that people in Texas, California, and Florida are paying for it, thereby making it a net gain for Pennsylvania. But of course, the people in Pennsylvania are paying for programs implemented elsewhere. It's all a big sham, an illusion to make people feel like they are somehow getting free money from Washington, when in reality, all we are doing is shuffling money around the country so that politicians can create better campaign commercials. Teachable moment. When you make everyone responsible for something, no one is responsible for anything. Every good manager knows that you can't announce to the whole office, "We're all responsible for maintaining the copier," because that ensures that you'll be out of paper and dry on toner in no time. And then the finger-pointing will start. To get something done, someone needs to be personally responsible. Guess what? Government works the same way. Remember the debacle after Hurricane Katrina? I don't know about you, but dealing with a cataclysmic disaster seems to me like the exact thing we have government around for. Yet after Katrina, there were plenty of agencies that were on site, but powerless. There was more finger-pointing than there was problem-solving. The buck didn't stop anywhere, so neither did the blame. Meanwhile, people suffered. Our money takes an expensive vacation to D.C. We covered lobbyists earlier, but the largest and most influential lobbying group in the country is made up of state and local governments. Over 88,000 different entities exist in the United States, and most of them receive some kind of federal aid. Unlike the early days of America, states are no longer shy about asking the feds for help. In fact, there is an entire industry called grantsmanship built around it. When Washington lets it become known that money is available, the states come begging. Aside from the larger problem of this making our states more and more dependent on the federal government, there's another issue: taxation with very little representation. Think about it. Income tax dollars go from you to Washington, where they are appropriated out to various big budget items. From there, They're refined into grants and programs, drawing everyone from state and local politicians to trade groups to unions to Washington to lobby for the money. Grant recipients are selected. I'm sure there's definitely no political horse trading going on. And the money then starts flowing. The problem is that federal tax dollars, instead of benefiting the nation as a whole, could easily go to finance some specific initiative in a state across the country, a state where you have absolutely no representation. The situation has gotten so bad that states now like to brag about their bounties as though grabbing as much cash as you can is a good thing. In Massachusetts, Governor Deval Patrick listed $33.6 million in federal funds for community development block grants as a headline on his website. In Wisconsin, Governor Jim Doyle announced $51 million in federal education funding. And in New York, Governor David Paterson bragged about applying to the federal government for $540 million in public safety grant requests to improve broadband communications. The special interest groups, of course, love this system. If you're a lobbyist for education or road construction, you no longer have to go on a tour of 50 state capitals to plead for cash. You can just go to Washington and lobby there. Bureaucracy as a business. Progressives want us to believe that while business people and the private sector are self-serving and profit-seeking, bureaucrats are just trying to benevolently fix other people's problems. We all know from experience that that is simply not true. Bureaucrats and politicians don't immediately profit the way a business does, but they are self-serving in other ways. They look for opportunities to expand their power and institutionalize their ability to continually extract money from others. Professor Fred McChesney of Northwestern University likens bureaucrats and politicians to the scoundrels in William Faulkner's novel, The Reavers. At night, scoundrels would go out to the country road and water it down. The next day, when a passing car sank into the mud they created the night before, they would show up with a mule and offer to pull it out, for a hefty price, of course. Not wanting to leave their cars behind and walk, the drivers were forced to pay. A more contemporary name for this kind of thing is scam. One way bureaucrats in Washington seek to institutionalize power is by continually promising money to the states, with strings attached. Think about the absurdity of this. Not only is Washington simply returning money to a state that it took from taxpayers in the first place, it often returns that money with additional requirements that, guess what, give the feds even more power and control. Many of the federal aid programs that are so often bragged about by politicians require states to set up new boards and agencies to direct these activities. And this is not exactly a new idea. To get money through the 1916 Highway Act, for example, states were required to create, fund, and run highway departments, and then regularly file reports back to Washington to update them on their progress. We've also seen how the federal government will provide highway funds in exchange for states agreeing to their nanny state regulations, like a 55-mile-per-hour speed limit. More recently, in 2009, Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal announced that he was declining federal stimulus money because Louisiana would have been required to raise taxes. Virtually the same thing happened again in 2010. The federal government passed an emergency $26 billion state aid package that was spun in the media as keeping teachers employed. "We can't stand by and do nothing," President Obama said, "while pink slips are given to the men and women who educate our children and keep our communities safe." That kind of language is not used by accident. It's intentionally meant to put massive heat on state politicians to accept the money, whatever the cost. The $26 billion, for example, may include requirements that states accepting the money cannot cut their education budgets in the following year. It would be prudent in not committing entirely to the idea of taking this money unless we know what the impact is and the potential unintended consequences, Michael Druniak, spokesman for New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, said after being asked by the media why the governor wasn't enthusiastically grabbing the money being offered. Teachable moment. After seeing all the strings attached to the federal stimulus money, states like New Jersey seem to be smartening up, but so are the feds. The $26 billion state aid package included a provision whereby the state cannot turn the money down. If they don't accept it, then the money will, according to the bill, bypass the state government and flow straight to recipients chosen by the U.S. Department of Education. A competitive state. Federalism is a far better system because, as Professor Charles Fried of Harvard Law School explained, it allows people to vote with their feet. If, for example, the people of Vermont want to outlaw French fries and the courts say that's okay, then people who want French fries can go to New Hampshire or Massachusetts to get them. If, on the other hand, the federal government outlaws French fries, you need to leave the country. The free market system works because businesses compete for customers. The competition, in turn, drives prices down and quality up. The federal government, on the other hand, is a monopoly. Don't like Social Security? Tough. Can't get a straight answer from OSHA? Too bad. Don't ever want to receive Medicare benefits? You're paying anyway. State competition is the only opportunity we have available to provide citizens with a way to get around the monopoly. There's probably nowhere in the country where the benefits of state competition can be seen as much as here in the Northeast. Between New York City, Connecticut's Fairfield County, the Gold Coast, and the greater Boston area, there is a lot of highly concentrated wealth. There are also a ton of taxes. That leaves people like me with a choice. Do I want to live in Manhattan and pay an enormous city income tax in addition to state and federal taxes? Do I want to live in Connecticut and pay only state and federal? Or do I want to move my company to New Hampshire and pay only federal income tax? It's nice to have a choice in tax rates. It would be nicer to have a choice in even more areas. New Jersey, which has always been a high-tax state, is beginning to see the benefits of being competitive. If Governor Christie is successful in lowering the cost of living and doing business in that state, I can guarantee you that people will flock there. New York will lose more of its tax base, and New Jersey will gain. It's competition at its finest. Obviously, there are certain things that only the federal government can do. We can't have competing armies or competing judicial systems, but that's why the federal government exists in the first place. Remember, the list of things they should do is pretty short. National security, judiciary, international relations, and patents and copyrights. Competition among states in those areas would be a disaster. And that, in fact, is a pretty good litmus test for figuring out whether a program or agency should be at the state or national level. If competition would be a bad thing, then the Fed should probably have it. Aside from continually pushing our leaders to ask that question about each and everything the federal government does, we must also reshape this entire debate. Never lose sight of the fact that we have the Constitution on our side. Others can complain and harass and name-call, but our framers agreed with us. Progressives have so successfully tarnished the idea of federalism that the default standard now seems to be that power automatically rests with the federal government. If you want local control, you have to fight for it. That's the opposite of how this should work. The default standard should be that power rests with the states and people. If the federal government wants a new program, agency, or initiative, then they should be forced to make the case as to why that power must reside in Washington. As in a criminal trial, the onus must be on the federal government to demonstrate, beyond a reasonable doubt, that something must be nationalized in order for it to work properly. ADD moment. That litmus test is probably not foolproof, but let's test it out with an example. Would competition among states for fighting poverty be a good thing or a bad thing? Good, of course. If Ohio comes up with a great program, then other states can adapt it. There's no reason there can't be national organizations to collect and share information and best practices. It's just that the actual funding and execution of ideas must happen locally. The politics of control. The first four topics we've covered in the plan so far all have something important in common. They push America toward control by elites. Think about it. From the degrading of individual rights to a push toward equality for everyone to the minimizing of the role of God in society to transferring power from states and cities to a central bureaucracy, it's all laying the groundwork for a new kind of aristocracy. But to get there, progressives must continue to buy off various voting blocks by redistributing wealth. And that's why federalism is such a big deal. State aid is just a really nice, really friendly way of talking about wealth redistribution without really talking about it. After all, if you take tax dollars from a wealthy person in Boston and send it to an anti-poverty program in Arizona under the guise of state aid, then what have you really done other than redistribute wealth? Some people might wonder why progressives would care whether that redistribution happens nationally or locally. If the state of Arizona takes tax dollars from a rich person and funnels it to that same anti-poverty program, isn't that just as good? No, and here's why. State tax rates are, for the most part, not as graduated as the federal system. Remember, in the federal tax system, almost half the population pays nothing, and the top 10% finances over 70% of our country's revenue. That's not the case in all states, and some states don't have income taxes at all, and instead rely on property or sales taxes, which, much to the chagrin of progressives, have flat rates. Howard Chernick, a professor at Hunter College who specializes in studying public aid, explained clearly why progressives fear more state control of tax dollars. In a decentralized federal system such as the United States, the realization of distributional goals requires the joint fiscal effort and cooperation of several layers of government. If fiscal responsibility for redistribution were left entirely to subnational levels of government, then states with weak fiscal capacity or limited preferences for redistribution might choose benefits and levels of access that fall below minimum. The federal government is not going to willingly give up the power it has accumulated. In fact, it's not even going to give it up unwillingly. The only way that we can return to the power-sharing arrangement envisioned by our founders is if people demand that their states stand up for their constitutionally guaranteed rights. That means taking extraordinarily strong stands on issues that in the past would have seemed like no-brainers. It means turning down federal aid, not participating in so-called compulsory national programs, and suing to demand that every federal initiative meets the 10th Amendment test. In some cases, this is already happening. Missouri voters, for example, recently passed Proposition C, the Health Care Freedom Act, which allows citizens there to opt out of Obamacare. The vote, much to the surprise of the national media, wasn't even close. 71% supported it. There are similar efforts afoot in other states, such as Oklahoma and Utah. In addition, at least 14 attorneys general are suing the federal government over the constitutionality of Obamacare. There's also a fire growing in states like Montana, South Dakota, and Wyoming, where governors, representing both political parties, signed legislation declaring that federal regulations of firearms don't apply if the weapon is made and used in their state. This may not seem like a big deal if you don't forge your own weapons, but it reasserts the sovereignty of the state and seeks to curtail the power of the federal government. There's an old riddle that you've probably heard before. How do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. The same logic applies here. Looking at everything that America faces seems overwhelming, to say the least. But the beauty of our system is that the founders set it up to be self-healing. We don't have to fix every other state. We just have to fix our own. We don't have to fix 300 million other Americans. We just have to fix ourselves. If we are better people and hold our local politicians to the Constitution, then we've done 99% of the work. Remember, even national figures like senators and congressmen are really just local politicians whom we've sent to represent us. Judge them on how they perform for their districts, not on how well they're doing climbing the political ladder in D.C., or how many important committees they've weaseled their way onto. Hundreds of years ago, our founders developed a system of power sharing that was unique to the world, a republic, not just in name, like the Romans once had, but also in function. It was a system set up to endure the test of time and of tyrants, a system that would set national goals but rely on local execution, a system that ensured the federal government could never grow too large because it didn't even have the power to give itself more power. Progressives have destroyed this system over time, but those of us who want to restore it have one big advantage. The system was designed to heal itself. Violence and aggression aren't required because the prescription for fixing the Constitution is the very power of legislation that it grants. Our framers knew that, despite their best efforts, we would reach a point where power had been amassed in the hands of a few, and they gave us the tools to amend their document and ensure that the people and states could again harness the powers that had been reserved for them. All it takes are some creative ideas and the strong will of people to implement them. In the next chapter, I lay out the ideas. I just need you to provide the will.
Only a crisis, real or perceived, produces real change. When that crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around. That, I believe, is our basic function, to develop alternatives to existing policies, to keep them alive and available until the politically impossible becomes politically inevitable. Milton Friedman. Chapter 17. Step 5. A taste of their own medicine. Progressives have consistently used claims of a crisis to further their agenda. So maybe it's time to give them a taste of their own medicine. We are in a crisis right now, and it doesn't need to be exaggerated or embellished. It's a constitutional crisis. We are so far removed from the actual language and intent of the Constitution that it's no wonder our system is broken. The emergencies that people want immediate reactions to, the jobs crisis, debt crisis, and corruption crisis, are only consequences of our constitutional crisis. So to borrow a phrase from Rahm Emanuel, let's not let this serious crisis go to waste. A lot of great ideas to strengthen our founding document have been proposed, but there are several that I think have a real chance at being politically possible and, once implemented, actually effective. In other words, these are not ideas that will be easy to pass but then act as nothing but window dressing, and conversely, they are also not ideas that might sound appealing but that are completely unrealistic, i.e., vote them all out. Just keep in mind that nothing will happen overnight, and while that can be frustrating, we must all keep pushing in the same direction. If we do our job, make our case, and never give in, then Milton Friedman's observation will eventually be our path to restoration, as the politically impossible someday becomes the politically inevitable.
Pass a balanced budget amendment. I wish it were possible to obtain a single amendment to our Constitution. I would be willing to depend on that alone for the reduction of the administration of our government to the genuine principles of its Constitution. I mean an article taking from the federal government the power of borrowing. Thomas Jefferson. I really don't like the idea of tinkering with our Constitution. I think it says what it needs to say in the simplest form possible. But sometimes there's no other choice. Sometimes, as Jefferson wrote years before he ever thought of a balanced budget amendment, when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. We don't need to throw off the government, but we do need to provide for our future security by reining in its ability to bankrupt us. And it looks like a balanced budget amendment is what it's going to take to do that. Nobel Prize-winning economist James Buchanan says that our nation's chronic deficits are the result of a structural flaw in our fiscal politics, and that the structural flaw requires structural correction, that is, constitutional constraint that will effectively change the basic rules for the fiscal game. The problem is that we've gotten to this place not because of any problem with the Constitution, but because of the evolving interpretation of it. A living constitution requires that our government constantly provide services equal to the societal norms of the time. That takes a lot of money to accomplish. In earlier times, the cost would have been a deal-breaker. But as Keynesianism took hold, that was no longer an issue. As Buchanan pointed out, politicians prior to World War II would have considered it to be immoral, to be a sin, to spend more than they were willing to generate in tax revenues, except during periods of extreme and temporary emergency. There were basic moral constraints in place. There was no need for an explicit fiscal rule in the written Constitution. But now, with the moral constraints long gone, there is an explicit need for a law. Our leaders have run deficits in 44 of the last 50 years, and the Obama budget projects them to continue for another decade straight. It's no longer a question of whether they can balance the budget on their own. Every ounce of data proves they cannot, so it's time to balance it for them. A constitutional amendment, while daunting to actually pass, would be the most effective and enduring way of guaranteeing that our leaders cannot spend us into serfdom. It doesn't have to be complicated, but there are a few things that have to be addressed to prevent the weasels from finding loopholes. 1. Spending cannot be higher than the prior year's amount, plus the rate of inflation and population growth. 2. If at the end of a given fiscal year, the estimates were wrong and the budget is still not balanced, the difference would automatically be cut from the budget for the next fiscal year according to a very specific predetermined formula. 3. An exception can be included for a war declared by Congress or a national calamity. The benchmark for meeting the definition of the latter would need to be quite high. Think something in the range of 90% of members of Congress agreeing. That may seem like an unrealistic bar, but how many politicians would have voted against declaring 9/11 or Hurricane Katrina a national calamity? 4.